Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bones of Belonging, Finding Wholeness in a White World, by Anahid Dashgard. Narrated by Samara Naimi. Dear listener, no matter who you are, this book is meant for you. The book is organized like the bones of the human body. Some pieces are longer, some shorter, some bearing more weight, others lighter in their touch. Start at the beginning, start in the middle, start at the end. Wherever you come in, the stories will take you where you need to go. The pieces overlap, one connected to another, each nudging you forward and inviting you to see, feel, and put together the skeleton of belonging holding our fragile humanity together. I started writing this book just after COVID-19 hit us, and finished as we began transitioning into a new post-pandemic normal. This timing was coincidental, but also significant, as the pandemic became a mirror reflecting and accentuating massive gaps in access to healthcare, mental health support, physical safety, and opportunity, based on little more than the color of one's skin. When the murder of George Floyd saw the United States, Canada, and other nations shatter along the fault lines of systemic racism, many workplaces, organizations, and communities were no longer just looking in the mirror. They were left holding the broken pieces with no idea how to put them back together. As someone who teaches and consults about issues of equity, diversity, and inclusion, I've come to realize that the biggest barrier to eliminating racism and other forms of systemic discrimination is that most people still don't understand the problem. When they look in the mirror, they don't know how to see these common bones of belonging within their own reflections. I hope these stories help show you our shared skeleton so you can better understand the effects of racism in ordinary life. Fostering a world where everyone matters and belongs requires an awakening of the heart space, an extension of empathy, the ability to understand reality beyond the limits of our own experience. I hope you see yourself or others you know reflected in these stories. But mostly, I hope these words kindle a desire to do better by each other, regardless. Bones. Stories are the bones of our belonging, to ourselves, to each other, and to the earth. Bones heal, hold together, carry weight, and endure. Put together, bones form a skeleton in the shape of a body, illuminating patterns of life and loss, memory and dreams, what it means to belong in and to the world. We never escape our brokenness, but when we tell our stories, we can make the bones beautiful. Survival. These under-eye circles keep getting darker and darker, twin galaxies of exhaustion where each day is a life. 1. Silver Birch. Month 1, March 2020.
Ouch!
I rub my head as it hits the car ceiling once again. The cottage we've rented is somewhere a few miles away on this bumpy road on the south end of the Canadian Shield, a couple hours from our city. We are surrounded by marshy swampland on either side. Straight-backed trees curled like a spine around the soft belly of lake behind them.
Did you know this is moose territory? I throw out, desperate to distract my children from their end-of-trip grumpiness.
But you have to be quiet. Wild animals don't like human noise. Their faces press to the glass and suddenly, stillness. I take a deep breath and rest my head on the window glass beside me.
The view isn't as good on my side. I never see any animals. She always gets to see them. It's not fair.
Coda, my 5-year-old son, complains loudly. And just like that, the silence is over. During this, his second year in kindergarten, he's often sullen for one reason or another. He has spent the last half year refusing to go to school each morning with no clear explanation as to why. Will this pandemic help or hurt him? I can't say. The time ahead feels like the road in front of us, slightly dangerous, with smooth passages as rare as the sighting of wildlife. We are 2 weeks into isolation,
introduced to a daily mutating pandemic vocabulary made up of phrases I hadn't previously known existed. COVID-19, social distancing, flattening the curve. Elderly people are dying in nursing homes across the country, unable to touch their loved ones for a last goodbye. Homeless shelters are hotbeds for transmission. Ambulances all over the world are being turned away from hospitals. We are told we will not have enough beds, enough ventilators for everyone who will get sick. But like the layers of rocks beneath us, this is merely one strata. My divorced elderly parents live across the country. My father remarried, my mother living on her own. I am too far away to visit, never mind protect either of them. Shaquille and I are two brown people running a small business in a time where one-third of small businesses are projected to go bankrupt. Overnight, most of our work has been canceled. We are in the middle of a house renovation with a now indeterminate end date, and the tiny apartment we rented back in the city is uninhabitable for four bodies full-time. We are temporarily homeless and incomeless, and I'm back to first-year mothering kind of sleeping hours. I thought exile was a thing far in the past. When I was 7 and heard that we had to flee Iran, a country in revolution, for England and then later Canada, my illusion of safety was shattered. I remember walking in our garden in downtown Tehran, repeating, "I hate Khomeini. I hate Khomeini." Taking in vain the name of the Islamic fundamentalist who had stolen our country, because I needed someone to blame for our forced eviction. Overnight, I lost connection to my family, community, language, and culture. Fear, deep and ongoing, branded the child I was, and so I grew up always expecting the worst to happen. I chased after the wrong boys, sacrificed health to addiction, and sabotaged happiness when it soaked in more than skin deep. It took me until midlife to realize I was stuck in a perpetual loop, going back over and over to that moment of breakage where everything familiar was erased almost overnight. In trauma studies, exile is placed at the top of the list of life stressors. What can be greater than forced displacement? The sudden fault line between the past, the country and place that holds you who you are, and the future waiting for you, the new you that will inhabit it. We are all in exile now.
"Look, silver birches," my son cries, his voice spiraling out the open window.
The trees are peeling, their bark fragments like mini prayer flags waving their allegiance to Mother Earth below. Sometime soon, with the coming of spring, these tree skins will let go in a biologically orchestrated dance downwards. Silver birch trees shed their bark gradually, a kind of grace in action. I wonder, will I be able to do the same again? The next morning, I enter the kitchen to put coffee grounds on. Since lockdown began, I've become a serial coffee and wine connoisseur, liquid bookends to each day. We are settled into a typical A-frame cottage on the Canadian Shield, this landmass over 4.2 billion years old covering over half of Canada and formerly home to volcanic mountain ranges. It's stunning to think of standing on top of more than 100 hardened plates of lava. We've been coming here every summer and fall for over 12 years now, the familiar rock cliffs on the drive up signaling a transition to a slower pace of living. Not this time, though. I can feel my body channeling these volcanic roots, erupting in emotion after emotion, and I'm waiting for the tempering effect of time to soothe all this volatile feeling into a more solid state of being. Each day now runs a loop of routines: working, parenting, cleaning, teaching, shopping, cooking. Although each of these tasks are stretched far beyond the time and energy they would usually consume. As I inhale the coffee fumes, I think back to yesterday, a typical day. 9 a.m. "Put the nuts back into the container," Shaquille nags. I catch my breath before I snap the first childish response that comes to mind. "Why don't you do it?" Or better yet, the blaming version. "Do you have to be so controlling?" Social media check. Hospitals across the country are frantically clearing ICU beds to prepare for COVID-19 invasion. 11 a.m. "Come back here," I yell at Coda. He always wants to avoid the reading part of his lessons, and I've run out of teacher engagement strategies, so I resort to good old parental enforcement. In this case, it looks like chasing him around the room and grabbing the back of his shirt to yank him back to the table to finish the last page of Days with Frog and Toad. Social media check. Idris Elba has the virus and is quarantining with his younger wife, who he praises as brave and resilient in choosing to stay with him. 12:30 p.m. Carrot sticks are splayed out across the table like train tracks beside a small yogurt lake and breadcrumb mountains. Come back here and clean this up, I holler again at the kids. I have gone from occasional yelling mom to daily yeller. When they do a remake of the classic film Old Yeller, I will apply. Social media check. Shelter occupancy is rising because of rising rates of domestic abuse. Domestic abuse deaths in some towns outpace COVID-related ones. 1 p.m. Hubby and I switch places. My turn at the desk in the bedroom. A chair propped in front of door to prevent kid entry, which has so far worked a grand total of 2 times. I try to compress 10 hours of work into 3 hours. Social media check. Our premier and foreign policy minister in warring political parties are now BFFs, chatting nightly to offer each other moral support. 4 p.m. We have our team check-in. We need a better project management system, one of our staff complains. I try to relax my facial muscles from betraying irritation. Can't they see how hard we are working to keep things afloat, to simply survive? Social media check. A local brewery has shifted from producing beer to making hand sanitizer. 5 p.m. I call my mother, who never complains, but who I can tell wants to stay on the phone beyond the 10 minutes I have before racing off to resolve a quickly escalating fight between my children. Social media check. Idris Elba again. He is now thanking healthcare staff for the excellent care he is receiving. Of course he would be. He's a movie star. 5:30 p.m. Dinner and cleanup. A repeat of the post-lunch table landscape, this time with the addition of tiny broccoli trees. I clean up this time because it's easier than trying to chase down my kids. Plus, my voice is hoarse. Social media check. A couple of friends have written and recorded a song encouraging love and hope. I make a mental note to add it to the growing list of things to come back to later. 7 p.m. Kid bedtime. After 3 interminable stories, Coda arises from the brink of sleep asking for water and wakes his sister to accompany him across the hall to get it. The trip takes 20 minutes. 8:45 p.m. The kids are finally asleep. How the hell is this day over already? I think about meditating but need to finish some work. Social media check. Trump is calling this a Chinese virus and claiming masks are unnecessary, contrary to what every scientist is saying and anyone with basic common sense. 10:45 p.m. Crap, it's late. Again. I consider meditating but feel too exhausted. Social media check. A short clip of our Prime Minister's daily update. I notice his beard is turning white. I note my own grays and wonder how the pandemic is accelerating their development. 2:30 a.m. Maybe I should take some more melatonin. Sleep feels another planet away. Coming back to the present moment, I take a sip of fresh coffee, gasping as it burns my mouth. I think how tensions can so easily become battle lines in this time of in-between. Partner versus partner, parent versus child, family member versus family member, co-worker versus boss. I wonder if they will also develop a vaccine to prevent the mental health fallouts from being on lockdown with double the workload and none of the usual supports. This pace feels nonstop, and I can't catch my breath amid all this doing at the cost of well-being. The fact that I'm even aware of the cost of my well-being is a mark of progress made over the years through all the earlier versions of myself. I pause from scrubbing last night's dirty pots to look out at blue lake water, still suffocated by layers of white ice, like my breath held rigidly in place by a locked diaphragm. Where is the time to exhale? With a virus that is stealing our species' breath away, are we making time to breathe more deeply? Am I? Month 2. April 2020. We're now a month and a half into social distancing, with restaurants, schools, and stores still indefinitely closed. The woods surrounding us are still covered in sheets of stubborn snow, although it's approaching the end of April. I grab my thick rain jacket to go for a walk with the little ones. Reaching the unpaved road, we decide to hike up through the birch trees. Orion, the eldest, wants to climb up the cliff in front of us, which means Coda will follow. I eyeball the slope and give my verdict. No, it's too steep. Unaware that Coda has already slipped past to go up the other side. He gets stuck halfway up, so I have to clamber up to rescue him, precariously holding him as we surf back down the icy slope together. Just when I think we're home free, I hit a hidden tree root and shoot up in the air, landing right on my tailbone. Coda, often the family caretaker, runs over to me.
Are you okay, Mama?
As he offers his hand to help me up. Together we walk and hobble our way back. I hear his voice suddenly cut through the frigid air, his breath appearing like smoke.
You know, if we walk that way,
he gestures through the forest to our right,
we'll reach the magical land.
Oh? What's that? I query, keeping my voice as neutral as possible.
It's the place where there's no hospitals and no one gets sick,
he whispers. I feel my back clench. Yes, I respond. That would be magical. I take his hand, conscious of how small it feels in mine. The next morning, I can't get out of bed. My lower back muscles have seized, and I can't move unless bent over double at the waist, shuffling forward like a giant mutant crab. I feel closer to 100 than to 50, and I fear that if I move too abruptly, I will dislocate my own backbone. What we are not told, when thrust into the liminal space of transformation, between whatever state of normal governed our lives and whatever the future will bring, is how excruciating the process can be. We're not forewarned about how we will be broken, how we will eventually be asked to surrender pieces of our past selves on the altar of the future. I've spent most of my life reconciling the first exile, struggling to grieve the tearing out of roots just when they were anchoring in the ground. I spent years transitioning, caught between what had been and where I wanted to be, sure that who I was belonged to where I was. After this period of lockdown, we will collectively face the loss of millions of jobs and the projected worst global recession since the Second World War. We will have to grapple with the discriminatory impact of this virus hitting lower-income and racialized communities with greater vehemence. We will need to find new ways of being. Will touch ever be taken for granted again? Perhaps hardest of all, we will have to learn to live with the newly awakened awareness that at any time, exile in the form of another pandemic or worse could happen again. Despite how much I have anchored my life into certain kinds of emotional and financial privileges, I seem to have forgotten how none of this is security against loss, death, and the unknown. My body, though, remembers. My body holds memory of the hostage-taking quality of fear, the heavy weight of sadness, and the restrained yet always ready to spill over rage. This back that is given out reminds me I have something to draw on. I am not in the land of exile without a compass. I hold in this body the memory of whispers of revolution, friends and colleagues taken off to prison to never return, the silent contagion of fear. The deaths in my country then were proportionally far greater than those lost to COVID in my country now. Is it not its own kind of macabre comfort that so many of us have these body memories of past exile, our own or ancestral experience, that communicate through body symptoms, reminding us of some time past where things came apart, and somehow, somewhere, we made it through? Our bones carry DNA of destruction and survival from this land that held and holds our ancestors. We are the benefactors of their resilience. After an emergency chiropractic session, I learned there is damage to the outer ring of my lower vertebrae, the shield of my spinal column, the same microsomal horseshoe shape as the shield of land we are currently living on. This mirroring does not feel like a wholly random coincidence. Shaquille bears the brunt of cooking, cleaning, and kid put down, while I sit watching, breathing through futile feelings of guilt. I know that I need to slow down and listen to my body, this patch of earth I landed in. Despite feeling resistant, I start doing things to support my back. Mini meditations, breathing exercises, slow stretches. One afternoon, lying down, I notice a rock-like tightness in my chest. I bring my attention to it, and it grows into a boulder pinning me down under its weight. Unable to move, I feel the boulder become a mountain, then a volcano spewing grief. Sobs erupt out of me for all we are losing. Tears of lava flow for all who have died. For the tired earth holding us up. I cry for my son who thinks magic is someplace else, but not here. I can't stop the grief once it has started. Only let it run its course. Once cleared, the turmoil inside calms somewhat. And as the days pass and the ground thaws, my spine gradually finds its right alignment again. The price of restoring wholeness is often vulnerability. Month 3, May 2020. A couple of weeks later, on one of the first mornings where the sun is both shining and hot, I'm able to walk again, slowly. I pull a pile of food from the fridge. "Let's go for a walk and have a picnic," I call to recruit the littles. Coda is the only taker. We meander together, watching frogs leap away from our approaching footsteps into puddles lining the side of the road. Monarch and tiny blue butterflies dance around our heads, and my son momentarily catches one between careful hands. When we reach the shallow part of the river nearby, I see a salmon caught headfirst under a rock, a rare wildlife sighting right in front of us. Its silver underbelly winks at me in the bright mid-afternoon sunlight, and I call Coda over, thinking it's swimming upstream. I quickly realize it's the opposite. The fish is dead, the exuberant flapping of its tail to and fro caused by the fast-moving current. Spring has arrived in her full glory, and today she is showing us her prized jewels. But even here, death is an inescapable part of reality. Sometimes, especially as I get older, I catch glimpses of the other me. The one dancing limbs akimbo in a living room in downtown Tehran, thick Persian rugs rolled aside, tables piled with trays of pulao and pistachios. I'm spinning in the center, laughing into the faces of those crowded into the room surrounding me. Yes, a part of who we are dies in the leaving. But it's also true that exile seduces you into believing that where you left is somehow the promised land compared to the uncertain future ahead. You think the best is over and what's to come is merely to be endured. Over the years, I've had to teach myself not to see dead fishes in every situation, not to search them out and turn them into whales that block the sun. I've had to learn to see the thousand shades of green, smell the hopeful mossy scent of earth after rain, and feel the solidity of the everlasting rock under my feet. Who I am today is a more sensitive and seasoned version of the person I left behind. How do we surrender to the waves of funereal suffering while also noticing the ways life unexpectedly pops up around us, like the million tiny tree buds I'm surrounded by now? During the pandemic, there was unprecedented cooperation across borders to develop a vaccine. Many countries like ours offered financial life supports like the Universal Basic Income and wage subsidy programs. And there were many accounts of wildlife frolicking and venturing into previously human-occupied spaces. There were neighbors shopping for neighbors, daily cheering sessions for healthcare workers, and a flurry of free online community gatherings. There is no panacea for exile. But what we notice and nurture during these times of transformation determines who we will be on the other side, and what we will be collectively. I notice my son's bright eyes staring up at me, tiny suns glowing in the familiar constellation of his face. After receiving so much of our attention over the last 2 months, he is a different boy, one who giggles and chases and hugs. His daily hug quotient since the pandemic started has quadrupled. Our response to this exile will become his future resilience, and I am grateful to have a map of sorts to pass on. Drawing in a deep breath, I let it out slowly like a shooting star of love from my heart to his. The words of an old childhood campfire song drift into memory. Land of the silver birch, home of the beaver, where still the mighty moose wanders at will, blue lake and rocky shore, I will return once more. As I release the words into the thrumming air around us, Coda shyly joins in, hitting every third or fourth word. In this time of stolen breath, I rejoice in feeling my ribcage inflate until I am pregnant, not only with unrelenting griefs, but also with seeds of fragile hope, whole worlds waiting to be born. We will return once more, but it will not be to the same place we started from. Exile changes us. But it's how we deal with what we have lost and left behind that determines whether we strengthen or break. My son and I sing loudly, rebelliously, as we walk down the rocky road atop this earth body we are lucky to always call our home. Meanwhile, silver birch trees stand bravely on either side with trunks bare, waiting like us for the restorative heat of summer. Dear Canada, I've known you now for close to 4 decades. You and I first met when I was a scrappy 9-year-old brown kid who arrived on your soil from Iran by way of England. Your grand open spaces shocked me after the boisterous, crowded streets of Tehran and the more placid yet still crowded townships of England. You took my breath away with the way your prairie sky could change shades from cobalt to cerulean to midnight blue, and the fact that we could drive for miles sometimes without seeing anyone on the road. Your endless, unblemished open spaces and younger culture held so much possibility. Anything could happen. I could be anyone here. Someone. That dream quickly died when I was made fun of, spat on at school, failed for no reason when trying for another Girl Guide badge. I stood out for reasons of both skin color and ethnicity, and it made me very afraid to stay with you. The never-ending whiteness of your winter landscape and of all the people surrounding us seemed like impenetrable barriers. Where was your heart, I wondered, as I closed mine off to you. Ours being an arranged relationship, leaving was not an option. I was forced to spend more time getting to know you, diving into shockingly cold yet serene lakes of turquoise nestled into your Rocky Mountains became second nature. I found my imagination sparked in the light-filled public library, a 20-minute walk from my childhood home, as it was anywhere else I traveled. I was cared for through multiple hospital visits, where as a new immigrant family, we never had to worry about costs. And then there were always people who appeared like magic at times when most needed. A superintendent who agreed to send me to a different school district, a neighbor who gifted a crocheted square, which I slept with throughout my entire childhood, a teacher who helped me create a high school chapter of Amnesty International that got me started on the path to activism. Through the thorny brambles of suspicion surrounding us, the goodness of your people found a way to seep past the protected facade I learned to put up. As a young adult, I began to travel across your vast landscape, gradually delighting in the diversity that I learned is such an essential part of who you are. I carefully picked sea-tossed pebbles off the wild ruggedness of your eastern shores while being welcomed into the homes of the most big-hearted people. I took the ferry to various Gulf islands off the coast of Vancouver and traversed the landscape that brought the Group of Seven to fame. The defining moments of growth for you over this last quarter century are also mine. I wept on first learning the plight of Indigenous people across this country through the Oka Crisis in 1990. I panicked at the 1995 Quebec referendum and the potential loss of one of our largest provinces. I marched in Quebec City against the free trade area of the Americas Agreement in 2001 with 100,000 others, and then again to protest Bush's invasion of Iraq 2 years later. I have voted in every election since reaching legal age and have organized national political campaigns sweeping shore to shore. I have talked to your media and politicians and jostled for a better, more just Canada. Over the years, you and I, we have learned to cohabitate. I am now an adult in middle age who has found her sea legs in Toronto, marrying another of your adopted brood, a brown boy from Pakistan who moved here too when he was young.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?